You're from Badger High School.
We have a few from Bigfoot and Williams Bay as well.
Well, thank you. Good. Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. We also have students from Oconomowoc High School. Would those students please stand? Good, and welcome to you all. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with the Court with Class program, which is a program administered by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. This program has won a couple of national awards. High schools from around the state are invited to come. They've given materials on the case they are about to hear. Some of these students may have met with lawyers in the community to discuss the case. And the students will then meet with a member of the court at noon to discuss the court procedures, not the substance of this case. All the students are welcome back at noon, and they will be joined by another high school class. And anyone else who would like to attend the noon session is cordially invited. I obviously have a cold, so if you'll excuse my acting. Let me introduce the court to you all now that we've met at least some of you. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Pat Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. My right is Justice William Babbage, and you will meet with Justice Babbage at noon. To his right is Justice Ann Ross Bradley, and on the far right is Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, 01-0327, Brittany Frost versus Doreen Whitbett. The first counsel to speak will be Virginia L. Newcomb, representing American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Ms. Newcomb.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I am representing American Family Mutual Insurance Company in this case so that this court may explore the intra-insured exclusion that's present in the American Family Homeowners Policy that was issued to Doreen Whitbeck. We are asking this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and reinstate the trial court's decision granting summary judgment. The facts developed in this case, the material facts are undisputed and uncontested, and I believe in applying the facts to the law produces this result. Really, there are three things that this court has to consider, and one of them is whether Tina Frost is a resident of Doreen Whitbeck's home at the time of this subject alleged dog bite in November of 1996. The second is whether Tina Frost is a relative of Doreen Whitbeck's. And if those two things are met, if Tina Frost is both a resident of the household as well as a relative of Doreen Whitbeck's, then the intra-insured exclusion applies. And for the court's convenience, we have put that in our brief. But basically, it is on pages 1 of 14, 9 of 14, and 10 of 14 in the policy. Finally, this court also must find that Brittany Frost is under 21 and either in Ms. Whitbeck's care at the time of this alleged incident or in the care of a resident relative, namely her mother, Tina Frost. First, the purpose of the intra-insured exclusion. The purpose is to exempt an insurer from liability who, on account of close family ties, might be partial in the case of injury.
Counsel, can I have just a preliminary question. I know that this is here. There was a grant of summary judgment on behalf of the trial court, and then there was a reversal by the Court of Appeals, which defined the term of the contract as ambiguous. But I noticed one of the arguments, and this goes to the summary judgment, seems to be that there's an argument by your opposing counsel as far as the material facts that are at issue. So I gather, and I don't, you didn't gloss over this, but I gather that their argument would be that there are issues of material facts, but that I see the appellate court didn't really get into that, but you look at their argument in the light most favorable. And do you think those are all settled and this court doesn't have to basically, well, concentrate on the ambiguity in the contract?
Yes, I do, Judge Justice Wilcox. I believe, first of all, in terms of the facts concerning the resident argument, that there are at least 27 different facts that are uncontested, which I believe this court can find Ms. Frost is a resident. The only thing that really is contested, and I can address that at this time, is whether Ms. Frost and her daughter were going to be going back to Kentucky. There is no evidence in this record whether or not there was any subsequent place for them to go. In other words, they haven't been looking for an apartment, haven't been looking for a home. There's no evidence to controvert the fact that at the time of this dog bite, there was the residency at Ms. Whitbeck's home.
Residency is a question of intent, isn't it? Important aspect is intent.
I would disagree how important it is. It is one aspect, and that is something that the court has addressed in previous case law. But the subjective intent is really a small factor when you look at all of the other things that are going on.
Intent is usually a fact for the jury, isn't it?
Intent is a fact for a jury in, for example, the intentional acts exclusion, which this court has examined. This court and the trial courts below have rarely granted summary judgment when the main issue is intent. But this court has found even that there are exceptions for that. For example, Raby versus Moe, which is a case that I argued in front of this court. In Raby versus Moe, this court found that there are some things that are so substantially certain to cause harm that intent may be inferred. So it's not always necessary to have a trial on the issue of intent.
The reason I raised this was primarily some questions that the chief asked, and the fact that in this case I noticed that there were belongings, personal property stored in both the state of Kentucky and in the state of Wisconsin. So that's the reason going to the intent, which is a temporary, you could have intent to vote in Madison and 10 days later or reside here and move up to northern Wisconsin. So that was the reason for the question.
One has to ask oneself if things are stored in a storage locker in Kentucky and a U-Haul of things, including a clothes dryer, including a television set, including the child's bed, including clothes and personal belongings, and weighing those two things, is the residence in the storage locker in Kentucky, or is the residence in the home where those things end up? So yes, the opposing counsel has brought up that fact, but I don't believe that is dispositive of the issue.
That's my understanding, that opposing party just raises the summary judgment issue on residence, not on relative. Is that right?
I'm sorry.
The issue about whether summary judgment should be granted or that there's a material fact was raised on residence. Was raised on residence, that's right. Not on the issue of a relative.
That's my understanding.
Okay. So you have two, to determine coverage, who has the burden of proof?
Well, the burden of proof is on American Family.
Right, okay. And you need to show two things, right? Residence and relative.
That's true.
Right. Now, who are we talking about in residence? Are we talking about the child, or are we talking about the mother?
Well, we are talking about the mother in terms of residence, because the intra-insured exclusion says that Brittany, if she's under the age of 21 and she is in either Ms. Whitbeck's care or in the care of a resident relative, then she would qualify as an insured. But for residency, the determination is strictly for Tina Frost.
The mother?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the child moved in with the mother in May, is that right?
May of 1996, yes.
And then left to be with the father in the summer in Kentucky.
Yes, that was after an initial alleged dog bite.
Right. We have to divide this into two bites, right? Because maybe one bite's covered, but the other isn't.
That isn't before this court, but I don't believe either is, because I think they were both residents and relatives for the first alleged bite as well as the second alleged bite.
Okay, so then the child moved back in September-ish, just when school was starting, right?
That's true.
The child wanted to go back home to Kentucky, right?
That's true.
Even though the mother had sole custody, obviously the father and the mother had agreed that the child could move back with the father.
That is not established in the record. There is nothing but Ms. Tina Frost's statement on the record, but there's no affidavit from the father. There's nothing else but a statement hanging out there.
But you agree the child wasn't in Wisconsin in the summer?
Yes, that's true.
All right. And so you're saying the mother was a resident?
Yes.
And who do we have to establish? Who's the relative that we're interested in here?
The relative that we're interested in is Tina Frost. And Doreen, Doreen Whitbeck.
All right. Do you want to say anything else about residence?
Again, going through some of the factors concerning residence, I would say that given the fact that Doreen Whitbeck allowed the Frosts to essentially move into her home, allowed them without a contract or any formal negotiation to simply pay what would be a fair share of the phone bill, utility bill. All of the evidence that is in the record concerning Ms. Frost using Ms. Whitbeck's address for her employment, for her 1996 income tax return, taking a child care dependent credit on the 1996 income tax return, Ms. Whitbeck allowing Ms. Frost to write checks on her Ms. Whitbeck's own checking account. In other words, Ms. Frost wrote the checks on Ms. Whitbeck's account. The fact that Ms. Whitbeck paid for some things such as uniforms for Ms. Frost. They reported to medical personnel in an important emergency room record, not only firmly establishing residency in Ms. Whitbeck's home, but also establishing the fact that Ms. Frost knew she was the cousin of Ms. Whitbeck.
I want to use that as a segue to the next part of this equation, that is relative.
That's a good time to do it.
Yes. And how do you define relative
Someone related by blood.
Not by blood or marriage, just by blood.
Well, for purposes of this case, by blood. Yes.
For purposes of this contract, I have the relevant provision, I think, is set forth on page 8 of your brief. For purposes of this insurance contract, how is the contract to be defined with regard to the term relative?
By using the dictionary definition, a common definition.
What is the definition of relative in this contract?
Someone related by blood or affinity.
Does affinity mean by marriage?
It could be, yes.
Or what does it mean other than by marriage? I never thought of something else other than marriage.
Well, for
example, I have affinity for a lot of people.
But for example, I think some of the courts have explored what we have referred to in the brief as the elasticity of the term.
Like the
stepson,
okay,
uncle-in-law,
okay.
Those kinds of things. So some people might define it broader than what I'm asking this court to do.
Assume that I believe in that Adam and Eve are our first parents. And I believe that strongly. Assume that. Aren't we all relatives under your definition?
I would hope not. But, you know, I think that one has to certainly draw the line.
Okay, that gets to the issue of remoteness, I think. Is that correct?
That's true.
Drawing the line. So where does this definition of relative in the policy draw the line? What is too remote? I think on page 25 and 26 of your brief, you say, no matter, I'm talking now about the very last line of page 25 and 26, you say, no matter how distant or remote the connection would qualify as a relative. I think I'm reading that correctly. I mean to read it correctly. I'll read the full sentence. No reasonable layperson would dispute that meaning or deny that a person connected to them by blood, no matter how distant or remote the connection, would qualify as a relative. Now you're saying, you can't go back to Adam and Eve because that's too remote. So remoteness does make a difference. How remote is too remote in your definition?
I suppose it would be whether I, as a layperson, could trace my ancestors. If I can trace my ancestors, and this is very easily done by the parties in this case, but if I can trace my ancestors, those people are related. They're relatives of mine.
In this case, I understand that the parties allegedly are related because their great, great grandfathers were brothers.
Well, there's really three connections, and those three connections are pointed out in answers to interrogatories, which we put in our appendix. The first is there's Miss Whitbeck's great grandfather and Miss Frost's great grandfather, who were brothers. That makes them third cousins. There is another set of grandfathers who were first cousins to one another. Miss Whitbeck's grandfather and Miss Frost's grandfather were first cousins, and then both Miss Whitbeck's mother and Miss Frost's mother were third cousins. So there's three different relations that they knew about, and it wasn't just discovering this after the dog bite occurred, which I think is important in this case. They knew they were relatives from the time they were 13 years old as childhood friends.
They were relatives, for instance. I'm told, I don't know if you know Judge Coffey. I'm a federal judge. I'm told by my Aunt Mildred that he...
Often comes up in oral argument.
That he and I are twice related. That his great-grandfather and my great-grandfather were brothers. And also that I'm related to him by both his mother's side and his dad's side. Now, I think there's probably no one in the world that would know this other than my Aunt Mildred. I have no idea, for instance, if Judge Coffey has siblings. But if he does, I'm related to them, under your definition. And I have no idea if his siblings, if Judge Coffey has children. And if one of his siblings or his siblings' children would rent an apartment to one of my children, are they then resident relatives?
Well, by renting the apartment, it wouldn't make any difference. But if they were living together, which is the fail-safe in this whole equation.
If they were friends, they met at camp and they became closest of friends, are they resident relatives if they live together?
Yes.
Even if they don't know it?
Oh, if they don't know it. Well, then the purpose of the intra-insured exclusion, I think, becomes a little bit more interesting because the purpose is to exempt people from liability when there's an opportunity for collusion. But I still think that applying a bright line test,
they are
relatives, they are living together in a close, intimate relationship, and they would be intra-insured, they would be co-insureds and not be able to claim against one another.
Let's just talk about the purpose for a moment, if I might. There's no question here that the child was bitten by a dog. The dog. Was it this dog?
That has not been determined. We don't know whether it could have been a neighbor's dog or an uninsured.
It might have been collusion here.
It could be, sure. We haven't explored that. We haven't gotten to the merits of the case. But that's what this is trying to prevent.
But suppose we determine that it was this dog, just for the moment. And therefore there is no collusion. Does that change your view of who a relative would be under this policy in this case?
No, it doesn't. There is a contract between American Family and Ms. Whitbeck. And that contract is plain on its face. It provides for coverage for any number of other things, but it does not provide for coverage when someone who is a relative is living with you and makes a claim against you. That's where the line is drawn in this contract.
So would the line be drawn if they were 20th cousins? If they were, you know, this relationship, as you pointed out, I think that's the trouble with the ambiguity argument or the issue is where do you draw the line? Where would you draw the line?
The line is where whenever someone is related by blood, and if it goes back, if you can trace it back, then and you know it, you're a relative of someone, whether it's a third or fourth cousin.
But here it was, quote, reasonable and obvious. I mean, this was, they knew, and it wasn't so remote.
That's true. It's a reasonable interpretation of this contract.
Well, we'd have to face the Adam and Eve argument later on. In other words, there must be some point where not everyone is related, and that would be unreasonable to assume that those people would be related.
Absolutely.
Just as a follow-up, I want to make sure I understand. Your definition, you believe that as defined in the policy, the term relative means and you have to know that it's your relative. Is that correct? Is knowledge that it's your relative essential to the definition?
I think you have to use a reasonable approach. You know, a reasonable person in the position of the insured would know that they are related. That's all that a contract asks for. Finally, I think there is something about Brittany Frost. Brittany Frost is in the care of Doreen Whitbeck for 12 hours of the day. That is by virtue of the working relationship they have. And though it is argued that Brittany is not necessarily enamored with Doreen Whitbeck, it's undisputed that Ms. Whitbeck was home, that her responsibility was to provide at least being present for Ms. For little Brittany, and in the event there was a problem, that she could call her mother.
This was during the nighttime.
Well, actually, there were some hours that were during the day, and I can bring those up for you. There was a time period in the morning between 7 a.m. and 8 a.m. That she was with Brittany, that Ms. Whitbeck was with Brittany, and then it would be from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. From 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. That totals 12 hours.
Brittany had a friend sleep over at the house, a six-year-old friend, and the dog bit the friend. Would the friend be excluded?
The friend would not be excluded, in my opinion. The friend of Brittany that is just staying over at the house. A friend would not have been a resident or in the care of a resident relative.
Meaning that neither Doreen nor Tina would be taking care of the friend?
Are you assuming that Doreen is home or Tina is home, either one of them is home? Yeah, no, but American Family would have to cover that loss.
Because the friend is not being taken care of, is that right?
Well, and the friend isn't a resident of the household.
No, but under you said the residence applies only to Tina.
Well, that's our focus, I think, what was our focus in this argument. But the exclusion, the insured, means you and, if residents of your household, any other person under the age of 21 in your care or in the care of your resident relatives.
Well, it seems to me that the person under care, under this language, does not have to be a relative.
Doesn't have to be a relative, but does have to be a resident.
No. No.
Insured means on page 114 of the policy, and I think I quoted it in the brief. Insured means you and, if residents of your household, number one, your relatives, and number two, any other person under the age of 21 in your care or in the care of your resident relatives. So, Brittany Frost does apply as an insured. Her little friend sleeping over would not apply as an insured.
With all due respect, the way I read it, Miss Frost is a relative. That's your contention.
That's absolutely right.
And she is a resident of the household.
That's true.
And your contention is Brittany, the child, is any other person under the age of 21 in either Miss Whitbeck's care, that's 12 hours a day, or in the care of Miss Frost, who is a resident relative.
Right.
Now, under Justice Prosser's example, Miss Frost has agreed to take care of that child for a night and is responsible to the parents for that child and is under the care of either Miss Frost or Miss Whitbeck. Right?
Right.
And so it is a person, this child sleeping over is a person under the age of 21 in Miss Whitbeck's care, 12 hours. Or in the care of Miss Frost, who's a resident relative. So why do you not exclude that child?
I see that my time is up, but I'll
answer the question.
Yes, thank you. Because of the opening phrase of that, of the definition for insured. Insured means you and if residents of your household. Now, I guess that's the way I honestly feel about it. I certainly, as representing American Family, want to be fair to the people that they're contracting with. I think that the little girl staying over would be covered, but I don't think Brittany Frost would.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Newcomb. You've got 5 minutes of rebuttal. Michael S. Anderson, representing Brittany Frost and Tina Frost. Second, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael Anderson. I practice at Axley Reynoldson in Madison, and I represent the plaintiffs, Brittany and Tina Frost. I will be arguing this morning that the word relative as used in the American Family Policy is ambiguous as a matter of law, that it is ambiguous as a matter of fact, and even if the word is unambiguous, read in the context of the policy is ambiguous. I will argue that this court's prior decisions have limited the scope of the resident relative exclusion to close relatives, to avoid the possibility of collusion. And I will argue that American Family's interpretation will increase, not decrease, the risk of collusion. I will argue that there is no competent evidence of relatedness in the record, and that by adopting American Family's analysis would create virtually insurmountable proof problems for future litigants. Finally, I will underscore that the evidence regarding whether the Frosts were residents of Ms. Whitbeck's apartment gives rise to competing inferences, and the trial court erred in resolving those factual issues on a motion for summary judgment. First, the American Family policy was ambiguous as a matter of law. In its petition for review in this matter, American Family argued that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in not looking at definitions of relative as they appear in various statutes. Then American Family did not discuss how the word relative is defined in the various statutes. We did in our brief, and although the definitions vary, the Frosts and the Whitbecks would not be relatives under any of those definitions. American Family cited the court to the Rhode Island decision in S. Jogren in support of its argument that relative is unambiguous as used in these kinds of clauses. However, we pointed out that the court in S. Jogren said that the term relative has inherent ambiguities. In that case, the insurance company argued, well, relative means at least related to you by blood or marriage. And the Jogren court said that didn't clear up any of the ambiguities. In its reply brief, and again this morning, Counsel for American Family argues that the word relative is subject to considerable elasticity. I suggest that elastic is a euphemism for ambiguous. Elastic means expandable or flexible. Elastic words have no clear and self-limiting definitions. This court in Haas held that the word relative in the context of an anti-lapse statute was ambiguous. The teaching of Haas is that the meaning of the word relative depends on the context in which the word is used. As this court has acknowledged in Cider, our brief at page 5, and the Court of Appeals in Rayburn relying on Cider, depending upon the facts of a case, the same statute or insurance policy may be found ambiguous in one setting and unambiguous in another. As a matter of law, the word relative, standing alone, is ambiguous in the context of the resident relative exclusion as applied to persons who may share a common great-great-grandparent.
Counsel, where does it get you?
Excuse me?
Where does it get you, even if we agree, and I tend to agree with you, that the word relative is ambiguous, only has meaning within context? But where does that get you if we find that it's ambiguous?
If the word relative is ambiguous, then coverage will be construed in favor of the insured, and there will be coverage for this loss.
Well, not necessarily.
Not necessarily, yes, but that is where I'm asking.
I know that, and I guess I looped over that. I should have anticipated that was your answer. But it seems to me that the relative in an insurance policy is always going to be ambiguous because we've got the Adam and Eve argument, you know, we're all related somehow. And so it really only takes on meaning within the context with which it is applied.
Yes.
Not with in the context of the policy, but with which it's applied. And I'm struck by the fact that these two people from the age of 13 considered themselves relatives and, in fact, referred to themselves as cousins. That's the context.
That's the context. Let me respond to that, Mr. Justice. The courts around the country have never discussed or found relatedness beyond 3 degrees. And what we have here is apparently 10 degrees. We believe that's significant. Moreover, some of those courts have believed that they were near the edge. They couldn't go much farther than 3 degrees without it being too remote.
But this run through that because it's, in other words, you're saying that courts have construed just 3 degrees a relative coverage?
Let me clarify that. The cases that were discussed by American Family in its brief, and I summarized them in my brief, talk about mothers-in-law, talk about brothers, talk about daughters, talk about sons.
And not a niece or a nephew.
Excuse me? It may well be. But all I'm saying is
that just didn't seem.
But none of them are more than 3 degrees removed. If you sit down and look at the relatedness and count up and over and down, it's 3 degrees. There's no 4, 5, 6, and we're talking about 10 here. This morning was the first time that Council for American Family has acknowledged that there must be a place, there must be a line to be drawn somewhere, and I would submit that. Acknowledgement suggests strongly that the policy without clarification is ambiguous. But let me also return to your question, Mr. Justice, because I think that the court's decisions in McCaw and Shannon are instructive. When I read those cases, what leaps off the page to me is how many times the court uses the word close, a common type of close relationship, living together as a family in a closely knit group. Because of close relationship by blood or marriage. To those persons to whom the insured on account of close family ties would be apt to be partial. The court has previously stressed that we're talking about close relationships, and the reason why the court has stressed that, I submit, is because it is those people who would be most likely to collude. This court said that bluntly in the Whirlpool case. The underlying...
Counsel,
excuse me.
If I could interrupt for a moment. What is the definition of the term that you are advocating here?
Relative?
Yes. The Court of Appeals didn't offer a definition. It just said it's ambiguous, therefore we construe it against the insurance company, end of story. So as far as I read the Court of Appeals opinion, it does not stand for the proposition that there is a definition.
And that's an interesting question because the cases that have discussed it don't provide a definition either. For example, the case of Jackson that we both discussed said, we don't know what it means, but it means at least a mother-in-law. Okay, the line's got to be drawn somewhere, but it's somewhere beyond mother-in-law.
Well, this isn't a case of you know it when you see it. In other words, if you're a niece and nephew, and I'm just trying to go through the degrees here, but there's no definition. In other words, no case, you just indicated there's no case that has a definition.
That's correct, Your Honor. They say that clearly a mother-in-law is within the definition. Clearly a cousin is within the definition.
I think some people might not want to acknowledge that relationship. But the point I'm getting at is, in your argument here, that's what I was trying to get to, just what is,
well,
reiterating Justice Sykes' question, what is relative? And you're saying, well, it's mother-in-law, father-in-law. That just doesn't seem to...
The court could look to the statutory definitions, which I set forth in a footnote in my brief.
What's the rationale for that? This is a private contract. It's not governed by statutory definitions.
The court in Moonen was construing an insurance policy and looked to the statutory definitions of motor vehicle, said it wasn't controlling, but that it would be helpful and that it's like looking at a dictionary. To the extent that the court believes that it would be helpful, as the court in Moonen did, we would submit that those definitions are, you know, generally consistent. The statutory definitions, they're not identical, but they're generally consistent, and they're much, much closer, much more narrowly drawn than 10 degrees.
Do some policies, I'm looking at your summary of the cases cited by opposing counsel, your summaries on page 10 and 11 of your brief, and 11, the Hayes case apparently contains definition in the policy of what constitutes a relative. Do many of the policies in the cases that you've read have a definition set forth in the policy of relative?
No, Your Honor. My recollection is that they do not. And moreover, my recollection is further that it's normally an easy question. It's a daughter, for example. It's a close relation.
In Hayes, apparently, the policy included foster child, and that's...
Yes,
there was some
that was unusual, yes. So then to return to the specific question, how do I define it, I would take two approaches. I would say that it's clearly not somebody 10 degrees removed, and I would say that it clearly is a close relation with the degrees of affinity and relatedness as set forth in the statutes, and if I were pushed, I would say 3 degrees. But seems to be consistent with the cases around the country that have discussed it. It seems to be the place where the courts begin to draw back and say, we really can't go further than that. Now, let me just discuss why this court has concluded that resident relative exclusions are enforceable in certain circumstances. The court in Whirlpool said bluntly, the underlying concern in Shannon was the possibility of family member collusion in intra-family lawsuits. The court found that the potential for mischief was sufficiently great that this court, quote, assumed collusion in all cases, end quote, where a family member makes a claim against another family member. Accordingly, I would submit that the appropriate question is the possibility of collusion great enough to warrant allowing a resident relative exclusion to bar a claim by a person who may share a common great-great-grandparent with the insured? Or, alternatively, as a matter of public policy, does a resident relative exclusion bar all claims, no matter how remote the common ancestor?
But again, counsel.
Yes.
I'm troubled by the fact that, just put it into my own context, that is a legitimate, the concern of collusion.
Yes.
Is legitimate for me with respect to somebody that's a very, very distant relative, if at all, but because I like them a lot, and we spend a lot of time. Whereas I can think of first cousins that I hardly know. So that concern is not there. So that gets me back to the point, don't we have to define this term really in terms of the context of the factual situation?
Well, the court...
You know, that's hard. You know, a bright-line rule is always good, but the legislature did not give us... Well, your policy does not give us a bright-line rule.
The policy of American Family does not give a bright-line rule. That's correct. Let me follow up on the collusion issue, because I think what you're saying is that good friends might be more inclined to collude than first cousins, and I would agree. And that's why I think that the court has drawn, no, it hasn't drawn a bright line, it has suggested that it has to be a very close relationship where that kind of collusion would be something reasonably to be anticipated. Let me suggest that if American Family's position is adopted, there will be a potential for greater collusion, not less collusion. The hypothetical is that a woman with a Rottweiler dog moves into the apartment of an old friend from grade school, and the dog bites a neighbor girl in the face. If American Family's interpretation of the policy is correct, what is to prevent these two good friends from colluding to remember that a dead parent of one of the women once said that they were shirt-tail relatives? What is to prevent them from colluding to recall that a dead parent of one of the women said they shared a common great-great-grandfather? And how could the insurer disprove the claimed relationship? How could the insurer avoid treating the friend as a relative and hence as an insured? American Family's position invites collusion. It doesn't do anything to lessen the possibility of collusion, and it was...
Let me just see if I understand this. In this case, the victim wants to get the benefit of the policy.
Correct.
And the resident relative would exclude the benefit.
Correct.
Now, in the case you just gave us, if I understood it, and I might not have, we are worried about liability of the resident relative, quotes.
Correct.
To third party.
Cuts both ways, yes.
Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So what you're saying, or what I'm hearing you say, is that how we define resident relative cuts both ways for the insurance company.
Correct.
One, it might exclude coverage here where the victim is the resident relative.
Yes.
What two, it might also exclude liability for the insurance company.
Or make them assume liability that they should not have been required to undertake.
Not have, depending on how you define resident relative.
Correct. I mean, just assume, for example, Frost was never told by Doreen's deceased mother that they were shirt-tail relatives. Assume they just knew that they were good friends. And assume that it was Tina's dog, my client's dog, that bit a neighbor girl. In that case, Tina and Doreen, the good friends, get together and collude and remember somebody's dead parent saying they were relatives.
They want to do that.
Excuse me?
Why would they want to collude?
So that there's coverage. So that the personal assets of the dog owner aren't exposed. I mean, collusion is a strong word. It means secret agreement or cooperation for an illegal or deceitful purpose, but that was the rationale that the court in Whirlpool gave. So, yes, I think that is the law of unintended consequences under American Family's argument.
Why would the policyholder in your hypothetical want to have her insurance policy cover that sort of a loss?
So
what incentive would there be to enter into that sort of collusion?
So
her rates are going to go up.
So, well, I don't know about underwriting. It may well be, but it would seem to me that the main reason would be so that her good friend from college or from grade school, who was living with her, wouldn't have her personal assets exposed.
So she'd have to determine ahead of time whether or not there was going to be excess coverage. So the wounds would have to be, in this case, less than, in other words, if the policy was for X amount.
Wouldn't be excess, it would be primary.
Primary.
That's correct.
Okay, here we exclude the resident relative and the child, right?
Yes, yes.
In your case, the person covered by the policy would be a resident relative.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's correct.
The difference between third party and first
exactly.
party.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. And that, again...
They'd want to expand the definition of resident relative when it's a matter of third-party liability.
Exactly.
And you want to contract the definition of resident relative when it is a matter of exclusion.
We believe that the best public policy would be to have a bright line closely circling the named insured for the reasons previously articulated by this court. And it cuts both ways when that definition is narrowly defined.
Now, counsel, you take the position, and we've now been discussing relative.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Let me just ask you before I move you into resident. If you were going to write this opinion, this is your big chance.
All right.
And you're going to write it in your favor.
All right.
How would the court write how would the court write the issue on relative? This is frankly, another way of stating the issue that's been posed to you previously of defining the term. Now, the circuit court here defined the, didn't say it was doing that. It says, what is the definition of resident? It doesn't sort of answer that, except that, about relative. It doesn't answer it. It looks to the statute, right? And then in the statute it says, so what's the definition of relative? It says you compute it according to degrees of kinship, looking to the statute.
Yes.
And then it says under 852.03, according to the chart, Doreen and Tina will be 5 degrees of kinship. You add that up, it's 10 degrees of kinship, and that's not off the chart. Rather, their relation fits quite nicely into the existing boxes of the chart displayed as 852.03. And that seems to be...
Yes. If I were writing the decision, Your Honor, I would write it consistent with McCaw and Shannon, that a relative must be somebody closely related to the named insured, and I would add no further removed than 3 degrees. I could understand 4 degrees. I frankly couldn't understand 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10. And none of the cases around the country extend that far either. Third degree is probably the right place. I can understand 4, even though there's no support for that in the other.
Okay, so that's how you would write relative, and this is 10 degrees, and it's out.
Way out.
So you'd give meaning to what you consider an ambiguous clause.
Yes, I think that the court should either determine that the clause is, that the word is ambiguous, and interpret it consistent with McCaw and Shannon, in which case there is coverage in this case, or the court should rule that it's ambiguous and that the coverage should be construed in favor of the insured.
Another way of doing it, just not define it, just say, look, this is outside.
Well, that's
we don't have to decide what's inside. We just know this is outside.
That's what the courts have done, yes.
That's what the courts have done. Okay.
Is there any problem for an insurance company to define relative to by blood, marriage, adoption, to the 10th degree?
To the 10th degree? Well, yes. I mean, I think that that will create insurmountable proof problems. We have argued in this court as well as at the Court of Appeals that there is no competent evidence of relatedness in this record. The only thing that we have is a statement many years ago to the young girls by Ms. Whitbeck's mother, now deceased, that they were Shirtail relatives. That's all that Tina ever heard. Apparently, Doreen was given further comments, and that was that... that they were, in fact, third cousins and had a common great-great-grandfather. But, I mean, it's the out-of-court statements of a deceased parent who perhaps has the knowledge of an Aunt Mildred and perhaps has only the folklore of the family that suggests that there must be some kind of Shirtail relationship. But that's the thin reed upon which this claim of relatedness is based, a single statement by a single now deceased person who was unable to be examined as to how she knew that or why she thought that there was relatedness. There's no family Bible, there's no tombstones, there's no birth certificates, there's none of the normal or usual evidence of relatedness.
But my question is the, in a sense, the authority of
the insurance company to define relative.
I think they
to the 10th degree.
Oh, you mean
or anything
well,
like? Then they'd have the burden of proof on an exclusion.
I submit that if the insurance company in this case had said to the 10th degree, or had said, as they argued, no matter how remote, I suggest that this court would have struck that exclusion as contrary to the public policy as stated by the courts in McCaw and Shannon, which says it has to be close. I mean, I don't think you're going to find anyone, Your Honor, that will say that 10 degrees is close. I don't think you're going to find anyone that says 8 degrees is close or 7 is close. I think you're going to find that close means about 3 degrees, period.
You're not arguing that it would be contrary to public policy to have Ms. Frost excluded.
Well, I believe that it would be. I believe that this court has said that it's the likelihood of collusion that makes who would normally be a third party appropriately designated as an insured.
But the likelihood of collusion can be good friends, likely could be significant others.
That's right. That's right. Why you
That's
have to...
That's not excluded under this policy.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. That's why... But that's why this court has said these family exclusions are enforceable, is because of the possibility that close relatives will collude.
Well, counsel, one of your theories is that since they failed to define relative, it's ambiguous and therefore must be construed against the insurance company.
Correct.
That's pretty
That's
much corn book law. But
That's right.
It seems to me that that doesn't get us a whole lot, because then even if we could have people in court coming in and saying, well, even if they're first cousins, based upon the case of Frost versus Whitbeck, if the insurance company fails to define relative, it's ambiguous and therefore...
I understand your point, Mr. Justice, and perhaps I didn't mention it, but my argument is that this court should either determine that it's ambiguous and therefore construe it against the insurance company and find coverage, or the court should interpret the language consistent with the decisions in the cases that I mentioned previously, McCaw and Shannon, and say that we will interpret it to mean what it would mean to an ordinary person. It means a close relative. It means somebody much closer than 10 degrees. I'd like to move on to the resident issue briefly, unless there are some...
Yes, but before you do, there's something in your brief that would indicate that this wasn't right for summary judgment either. Just quickly state that. I know there's a dispute about that, whether it's in your petition for review, but just summarize that
yes, Your
very
Honor.
Quickly.
Yes. Counsel for American Family takes the position that the issue of the evidence of relatedness is not properly before this court because I did not file a cross petition for review. Under 80962 point or sub 7, my understanding from the quote, a party who seeks a modification of an adverse decision of the Court of Appeals has to file a cross petition. The Court of Appeals didn't resolve this issue. The court didn't have to resolve it because they said that the fact that it was ambiguous was dispositive. So I don't have an adverse decision of the Court of Appeals to cross petition. My understanding was that no cross petition was required.
But do you want us to decide this issue, or do you want it to go back?
I would ask this court conclude and direct that the out-of-court statements of a deceased parent as to relatedness are not sufficient to prove that these people were in fact related to 10 degrees if the court determines that 10 degrees is not too remote.
Did you make that objection in the trial court?
Yes, that issue was raised before the trial court and the Court of Appeals.
All right, counsel, would you move on to... You only have to win on one of these.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Either way.
That's correct.
Because they have to prove both, right?
That's correct. Okay. There are factual disputes on the residence issue, and I see that I have my warning light on. Brittany was at the Whitbeck apartment for 1 week when she was bit for the first time. Clearly, as of that date, there are at least inferences that she was not a resident, and it was inappropriate for the trial court to suggest that as of that one-week anniversary, she was a resident of Ms. Whitbeck's apartment. She then left and went to Kentucky to live with her father for most of the summer. She was obviously not a resident of Ms. Whitbeck's apartment when she was living in Kentucky with her father. She came back shortly before school, and about the same time, her mom, my client Tina, advised Ms. Whitbeck that they would be moving out in early December at the school break, and Brittany was going to go back to Kentucky to live with her family. For the next 2.5 months, Brittany slept on the couch. Brittany and her mom ate out at fast food restaurants. They had nothing to do with Ms. Whitbeck. This, may I say that counsel has argued that Brittany was in the care of Ms. Whitbeck. That wasn't raised before the Court of Appeals, and the evidence in the record is diametrically opposed to that. Ms. Whitbeck said that she had nothing to do with the kid. She was a latchkey kid with another adult in the home. They didn't get along, they didn't talk, they didn't go anywhere, they didn't act like family. And then immediately after the second dog bite, Brittany went home permanently to live with her father in Kentucky. I would suggest that the evidence is overwhelming that Brittany was not at any time.
Well, who are we talking about? I mean, the American family is not talking about Brittany being a resident.
You know, that's an interesting question because that's what she said. But did you hear in response to the question about the sleepover friend? There is that first clause. They have tried to read that first clause out of the policy in their briefing. But in fact, Brittany must be a resident because the definition is residence. And then there's the sub one and the sub two. So she has to be a resident, and she has to be a relative. She has to be both. American Family has suggested that her residence somehow flows and follows necessarily with the residency of her mother, relying on Martini, Ross versus Martini. But we have demonstrated that that case is different. In Ross, the custodial parent had an injunction against him for a year. The court said that because the custodial parent wanted the child back at the end of the injunction, residents remained with the father. In our case, the custodial parent said, she's going to Kentucky. Now, that might be unusual for the custodial parent to say that the child is going to go live with her non-custodial father, but that's the fact. And so the Ross versus Martini case really doesn't have any bearing. And in fact, the argument that Council for American Family closed their argument with on page 16. When it comes to a residency analysis, the wishes of the legal guardian control the child's destiny. We agree. The legal guardian said the child is going to go back to live with his dad, with her dad, at the school break in early December. The decision had been made by both the custodial parent and the six-year-old child, whose wishes, whose intentions, whose desires were to be in Kentucky and to get back there as soon as possible.
So the threshold issue in this case is the residency issue and not the issue of the definition of relative.
Well, I would
as opposed to the way the Court of Appeals had it structured.
The question of relative, if this court finds that this is just too remote, is the end of the discussion. If the court were to conclude that 10 degrees is not too remote, then the court should get to the residency question because that would have to be sent back for further factual findings. But if the question is, if the court were to conclude there's no relatedness, the coverage issue is resolved.
I find this very troublesome. I don't know how to read subsection 5. Insured means you. Okay, that's Whitbeck, right?
Correct.
And if residents of your household, okay, so any residents, but then that's further narrowed. So residents, they can be either Brittany or Miss Frost. If residents of your household, your relatives, right?
Correct.
And Miss Whitbeck's relatives are Brittany and the mother.
Well, that's American Family's argument, yes.
That, I mean, whether they are related, whether they are relatives
right.
within this,
right?
Right.
Right.
So we got the question of residents being Brittany and the mother, relatives being Brittany and the mother, under A1, 5A1.
Yep.
Then we get to, and, just what Justice Prosser raised, any other person. So it could be, doesn't have to be a relative, and it doesn't have to be a resident.
It has to be a resident because of the first
that's
sentence.
That's your position.
And that's American Families as well, yes.
If a resident of your household, any other person, meaning other than a relative, that's how
under
you
sub mean. 2?
Yeah, under sub 2.
Correct.
Under the age of 21, in your care or in the care of your resident relative.
Correct. So Brittany must be a resident, and she must be a relative. It isn't just Tina that must be the resident. They both must be residents, and American Family agrees with that interpretation.
What would be a hypothetical person who would fit the category of sub 5A2?
A foster child.
A foster child. In the care of a resident relative.
Yes. A good friend who is residing there in the care of a resident relative. My light is on. I'd be pleased to respond to further questions, but
thank you.
I will sit down.
Ms. Newcomb.
Excuse me.
How do you read 5A? Yeah, under 1 and 2, does it have to be a resident?
You're talking about Brittany?
Yes.
Yes.
Or the foster child, or the child coming in for the night.
Yes. Again, I would read that as the person must be a resident of the household.
Brittany has to be a resident.
Yes, she does. And I think on November of 1996, you have to ask the question, if she is not a resident of Ms. Whitbeck's household by attending school, by having her address on the school records, by having her mother claim her as a dependent for income tax purposes, where is she a resident, if not in that household? There is no other place that this child has been claimed. There is nothing in opposition, no affidavit, no information that's been provided to myself or to any court which provides any other information but that Brittany Frost is a resident of the Whitbeck household at the time of this. Now, what the intention was a month from then or 2 months from then is, I think, irrelevant to what this court has to do. I may intend to move from my home and have my home up for sale, but it does not make my home not my residence. It is my residence because there isn't another alternative.
Well, let me pose a hypothetical to you. Trina is the mother, right?
I'm sorry?
Trina is the mother here.
Tina, yes.
Tina. Okay, let's get the relative out of the way. So let's just say she's a sister of Mrs. Frost. Okay, so there's no question that she's a relative. And Tina has her daughter, Brittany, come and visit her for 1 week. Daughter is in the custody of dad back in Kentucky. And then she gets bit. Brittany gets bit. Are you saying that she's not that she is covered?
There would be no exclusion. There would be no exclusion that would be applicable in that case because the child would not be a resident of the household with just a temporary visit.
Yeah, I'm somewhat surprised you're conceding that.
Well, I think that's a fair reading of the policy.
And yet the underlying purpose, which is to limit collusion, doesn't seem to play out then, if that's your response. The collusion between the mother, who has the temporary visitation rights of her daughter. I mean, there still would be the potential for collusion, but you're saying
there is the potential for collusion, but the way this contract is written, American Family is saying just being related is not enough. It's not enough. We're going to say that in order to be excluded, you also have to be a resident, because it's a fail-safe. That makes the close, intimate relationship that they're talking about in all of the case law that has addressed this issue, that's what they're talking about.
Well, given your interpretation, what's the necessity of that second clause, any other person under the age of 21 in your care? I mean, if she has to be a resident and a relative, why do you even need sub 2?
She doesn't need to be a relative. She just has to be a resident and be under the age of 21, or be a resident and then in the care of a resident relative. Okay.
How does this policy treat domestic partners?
That issue hasn't been addressed. I have litigated that issue, and it has gone up to the Court of Appeals, but this court has not addressed that issue of domestic partnership. So that is yet to be determined.
What's American Family's position?
On domestic partnership?
Does it come within this clause of resident relative?
I would say that our case in front of us does, we don't have to get into that knotty issue, but that there might be certainly an attorney who would say and argue that affinity, if you look at the common dictionary definition of relative, would include someone who has a relationship that is non-traditional, but there have to be some contract or something that perhaps they had a marriage, but it isn't recognized by the state, but it's a marriage. It's another issue, I believe.
Okay.
Thank you. My light is on.
Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Newcomb. Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your argument in this case. This concludes 010327, Brittany Frost versus Doreen.